and had receded. The United States stood behind only Russia, China, and Australia as the largest nation in the world, whereas its economic power dwarfed those states. By European concepts of space and distance, America's size was truly astonishing. It was as far from San Francisco to Boston as it was from Madrid to Moscow. Texas alone was bigger than France, and the Arizona Territory was larger than all of Great Britain. The population, too, was growing. Science, invention, and the arts were thriving, and a competitive balance had again reappeared in politics. Throughout her entire history, however, the United States had repeatedly put off dealing with the issue of slavery. First through constitutional compromise, then through appeals to bipartisan goodwill, then through a political party system that sought to squelch discussion through spoils, then finally through compromises, all combined with threats and warnings about disunion. By the 1850s, however, the structure built by the founders revealed dangerous cracks in the framework. Philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson warned that acquisition of the Mexican cession territories, with its potential for sectional conflict, would be akin to taking arsenic. How much longer could the nation ignore slavery? And how much longer would the perpetual motion machine of growing government power spawned by Van Buren spin before abolitionist voices were thrust to the fore? The answer to both questions was, not long. The Dark Nether Side. Opponents of capitalism, especially those who disparaged northern factories and big cities, began their attacks in earnest for the first time in American history. Certainly, there was much to lament about the cities. Crime was rampant. New York City had as high a homicide rate in 1860 per 100,000 people as it did in the year 2000, based on the FBI's uniform crime reports. After falling in the 1830s, homicides in New York nearly tripled to 15 per 100,000 by 1860. Some of the increase in homicides came as a result of the influx of Irish Catholic immigrants, causing clashes between nativists and immigrants, and uniformed police made their first appearance. By far the worst sections of New York's dark nether side, as reformers of the day called it, included Hell's Kitchen, which by the late 1850s had started to replace the Bowery as the most dangerous and notorious section of the city. Hell's Kitchen received its name from policemen, one of whom complained that the place was worse than hell itself, to which the other replied, "Hell's a mild climate. This is Hell's Kitchen, no less." According to one writer, the Bowery, Hell's Kitchen, and other rough sections of town, such as Ragpicker's Row, Mulligan Alley, Satan's Circus, and Cockroach Row, consisted of streets ill-paved, broken by carts and omnibuses into ruts and perilous gullies, obstructed by boxes and signboards, impassable by reason of thronging vehicles, and filled with filth and garbage, which was left where it had been thrown to rot and send out its pestiferous fumes, breeding fever and cholera. The writer found hacks, carts, and omnibuses choking the thoroughfares, their Jehu drivers dashing through the crowd furiously, reckless of life. Women and children were knocked down and trampled on. Hackmen overcharged and were insolent to their passengers. Baggage smashers haunted the docks. Rowdyism seemed to rule the city. It was at risk of your life that you walked the streets late at night. The club, the knife, the slung shot, the revolver were in constant activity. Like other cities, New York had seen rapid population increases, leaping from 123,000 in 1820 to 515,000 in 1850, mostly because of immigrants, people Charles Loring Brace called the dangerous classes. Immigrants provided political clout, leapfrogging New York past Boston, Philadelphia, and Baltimore in size. But they also presented a growing problem, especially when it came to housing. The tenement population, which had reached 500,000, included 18,000 who lived in cellars, in addition to 15,000 beggars and 30,000 unsupervised children, apparently orphans. When the state legislature investigated the tenements, it concluded that cattle lived better than some New Yorkers. Prostitution and begging were omnipresent, even in the presence of policemen who lounged about, gaped, gossiped, drank, and smoked, inactively useless upon street corners. Some women used babies as props, renting them and then entering saloons, inducing them to cry by pinching them in order to solicit alms. Gangs were also seen everywhere in the slums, sporting names such as the Dead Rabbits, the Gorillas, the East Side Dramatic and Pleasure Club, and the Limburger Roarers. Politicians like Boss Tweed employed the gangs on election day, paid in cash and alcohol, to disrupt the polling places of the opponent, intimidating and, if necessary, beating up anyone with an intention of voting there. No wonder the English writer Rudyard Kipling, who visited New York, thought its streets were first cousins to a Zanzibar foreshore or kin to the approaches of a Zulu kraal, a shiftless outcome of squalid barbarism and reckless extravagance. Cast into this fetid urban setting were masses of immigrants. The United States moved past the 50,000 per year immigrant level in 1832, but by 1840, nearly 15 times that many people would arrive from Ireland alone. Overall, foreign-born and immigrants in the U.S. rose from 60,000 in 1820 to 2.2 million by 1850, with Wisconsin, New York, California and the Minnesota Territory receiving the most newcomers. In those states and Minnesota, immigrants made up 20% or more of the total population. But Ohio, Louisiana, Illinois, Missouri, Iowa, Michigan, and Pennsylvania were not far behind, since immigrants made up between 10 to 20% of their populations. Steam-powered sailing vessels made the transatlantic crossing faster and easier, and the United States had generally open borders. Still, immigrants had to want to come to America. After all, both Canada and Mexico were approximately the same distance from Europe, yet they attracted only a handful of immigrants by comparison. Lured by jobs, land, and low taxes, a small standing army with no conscription, a relatively tiny government, complete absence of mandatory state church tithes, no state press censorship, and no czarist or emperor's secret police, Europeans thronged to American shores. As early as 1818, John Doyle, an Irish immigrant to Philadelphia who had found work as a printer and a map seller, wrote home, "I am doing astonishingly well, thanks be to God, and was able on the 16th of this month to make a deposit of $100 in the Bank of the United States. Here a man is allowed to thrive and flourish without having a penny taken out of his pocket by government. No visits from tax-gatherers, constables, or soldiers." Following the potato famine in Ireland in the 1840s, when one-third of the total population of Ireland disappeared, new waves of poor Irish arrived in Boston and New York City, with an estimated 20% of those who set sail dying en route. From 1841 to 1850, 780,000 Irish arrived on American shores, and unlike other immigrants, they arrived as families, not as single males. Then from 1851 to 1860, another 914,000 immigrated. Eventually, there were more Irish in America than in Ireland, and more Irish in New York than in Dublin. Fresh from decades of political repression by the British, the Irish congregated in big coastal cities and, seeing the opportunity to belong to part of the power structure, they, more than any other immigrant group, moved into the police and fire departments. An 1869 list of New York City's Irish and German office holders, the only two immigrant groups even mentioned, revealed the stunning dominance of the Irish. Mayor's office, Germans 2, Irish 11. Alderman, Germans 2, Irish 34. Street department, Germans 0, Irish 87. Comptroller, Germans 2, Irish 126. Sheriff, Germans 1, Irish 23. Police captains, Germans 0, Irish 32. Hibernian primacy in New York City administration was so overwhelming that even in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attack in New York City a century and a half later, the names of the slain firefighters and police were overwhelmingly Irish. Although some moved south, especially the Presbyterian Scots-Irish, new immigrants from the Emerald Isle generally remained urban and northern. Moreover, the new Irish were Catholic Irish, who repudiated latitudinarianism and arrived with their own priests. They had little experience with common law. Such malleability when it came to voters meant that big city bosses herd them like livestock, told them whom to vote for, and warned them not to think for themselves. Some already saw this as a problem. An editorial in 1855 from The Citizen, an Irish-American newspaper, noted, "Westward ho! The great mistake that emigrants, particularly Irish emigrants, make on arriving in this country is that they remain in New York and other Atlantic cities till they are ruined, instead of proceeding at once to the Western country where a virgin soil teeming with plenty invites them to its bosom." It was true that land was virtually free on the frontier, even if basic tools were not. Stephen Thernstrom found that if immigrants simply left New England, their chances for economic success dramatically improved, especially as they moved into the ranks of skilled laborers. More than the Dutch or Germans, the Irish suffered tremendous discrimination. The work of a deranged Protestant girl, Maria Monk, Awful Disclosures of the Hotel Dieu in Montreal, 1836, circulated in the United States and fomented anti-Catholic bias that touched off the No Popery crusade that afflicted the predominantly Catholic Irish. Monk's surreal work related incredibly fantastic tales of her life in a convent in Montreal, where she claimed to have observed tunnels leading to the burial grounds for the babies produced by the illicit relations between priests and nuns, as well as allegations of seductions in confessionals. The church launched a number of convent inspections that completely disproved these nonsensical claims, but the book had its effect. Protestant mobs in Philadelphia, reacting to the bishop's request for tax money to fund parochial schools, stormed the Irish sector of town and set off dynamite in Catholic churches. More than other older immigrant groups, the Irish gravitated to the Democratic Party in overwhelming numbers, partly because of the anti-elite appeal of the Democrats, which was largely imaginary. Politically, the Irish advanced steadily by using the Democratic Party machinery to elect Irishmen as the mayors of Boston in the 1880s. But there was an underside to this American dream, because the Irish brought to America a settled tradition of regarding the formal government as illegitimate and the informal one as bearing the true impress of popular sovereignty. Political corruption was ignored. Stealing an election was rascally, not to be approved, but neither quite to be abhorred. That translated into widespread graft, bribery, and vote fraud, which was made all the easier by party politics that simply required that the parties get out the vote, not get out the legal vote. These traits and Irish willingness to vote as a bloc for the Democrats made them targets for the Know-Nothing Party and other nativist groups. The experiences of Germans, the other main immigrant group, differed sharply from the Irish. First recruited to come to Pennsylvania by William Penn, Germans came to the United States in a wave, 951,000 in the 1850s, following the failure of the 1848 democratic revolutions in Germany. Early Germans in Philadelphia were Mennonites, but other religious Germans followed, including Amish and Calvinists, originating the popular but wrong name Pennsylvania Dutch, which was a mispronunciation of Deutsch. Germans often brought more skills than the Irish, especially in the steel, mechanical, musical instrument trades, including Rudolf Wurlitzer and later Henry Steinway, and brewing, with brewers such as Schlitz, Pabst, and Budweiser. But they also had more experience in land ownership and had no shortage of good ideas, including the Kentucky Long Rifle and the Conestoga Wagon. John Augustus Roebling invented the wire cable for the suspension bridge to Brooklyn. John Bausch and Henry Lom pioneered eyeglass lens manufacturing, and Henry Hines built a powerful food company from the ground up. Above all, the Germans were farmers, with their farming communities spreading throughout the Appalachian Valley. Berlins and Frankfurts frequently appear on the map of mid-American towns. For many of them, America did not offer escape so much as opportunity to improve. Unlike the Irish, Germans immediately moved to open land, heading for the German-like northern tier of the Midwest and populating some of the rapidly growing cities there, such as Cincinnati, which in 1860 had 161,000 people, nearly half of them foreign-born, Milwaukee, St. Louis, and even as far southwest as Texas. One should take care not to emphasize the urban ethnic component of discord in American life too much. For every bar fight in Boston, there was at least one, if not 10, in saloons on the frontier. In Alabama, for example, the local editor of the Cahaba paper editorialized in 1856 that guns and pistols were fired in and from the alleyways and streets of the town so frequently that it was hardly safe to go from house to house. A knife fight on the floor of the Arkansas House led to the gutting of one state representative over the relatively innocuous issue of putting out a bounty on wolf pelts, and a few years later, in 1847, one set of bank directors at the Farmers and Merchants Bank in Nashville engaged in a gun battle with other directors outside the courtroom. Many of these clashes were family feuds. Most lacked an ethnic component. One ethnic group that has suffered great persecution in modern times came to America virtually unnoticed. The first Jews had come to New Amsterdam in 1654, establishing the first North American synagogue a half century later. Over time, a thriving community emerged in what became New York, which by 1914 had become home to half of all European Jews living in the United States. By 1850, there were perhaps 30,000 Jews in the United States, but within the next 30 years, the number would grow to more than 500,000. After the boom in textiles in the early 1800s, the Jews emerged as the dominant force in New York's needle trade, owning all but 17 of the 241 clothing firms in New York City in 1885. The largest influx of Jews took place long after the Civil War, when Russian Jews sought sanctuary from Tsarist persecutions. Nevertheless, Jews achieved distinctions during the Civil War on both the Union and Confederate sides. Best known, probably, was Judah P. Benjamin, a Louisiana Whig who was the first Jew elected to the U.S. Senate and who served as the Confederacy's Secretary of State. But five Jews won the Medal of Honor for the Union. Edward Rosewater, Lincoln's telegrapher, was Jewish, and the Cardozo family of New York produced important legal minds both before and after the conflict, including a state Supreme Court justice, Jacob, and a United States Supreme Court justice, Benjamin, who followed Louis Brandeis, yet another Jew, onto the Supreme Court. all the immigrant groups found niches and all succeeded, admittedly at different rates. All except one, that is. African Americans, most of whom came to the colonies as slaves, could point to small communities of free men of color in the North and list numerous achievements. Yet their accomplishments only served to contrast their freedom with the bondage of millions of blacks in the same nation, in some cases only miles away. Slavery still. 30 years after the Missouri Compromise threatened to unravel the Union, the issue of slavery persevered as strongly as ever. Historians have remained puzzled by several anomalies regarding slavery. For example, even though by the 1850s there were higher profits in manufacturing in the South than in plantation farming, few planters gave up their gang-based labor systems to open factories. Several facts about slavery must thus be acknowledged at the outset. 1. Although slavery was profitable, profits and property rights alone did not explain its perpetuation. 2. The same free market that allowed Africans to be bought and sold at the same time exerted powerful pressures to liberate them. And 3. Southerners needed the force of government to maintain and expand slavery, and without it, a combination of the market and slave revolts would have ultimately ended the institution. In sum, slavery embodied the worst aspects of unfettered capitalism wedded to uninhibited government power, all turning on the egregiously flawed definition of a human as property. Although the vast majority of Southern blacks were slaves prior to 1860, there were nonetheless a significant number of free African Americans living in what would become the Confederacy. As many as 262,000 free blacks lived in the South, with the ratio higher in the Upper South than in the Lower. In Virginia, for example, census returns counted more than 58,000 free blacks out of a total black population of 548,000, and the number of free blacks had actually increased by about 3,700 in the decade prior to the Civil War. A large majority of those free African Americans lived in Alexandria, Fredericksburg, Norfolk, Lynchburg, and Petersburg. Virginia debated expelling all free blacks in 1832, but the measure, which was tied to a bill for gradual, compensated emancipation, failed. Free blacks could stay, but for how long? South Carolina had passed a bill in 1800 requiring that any freed slave be able to function economically and support himself, meaning that most of these who gained freedom had acquired skills and training while in bondage. Private manumission was banned in South Carolina 20 years later, although the legislature still freed slaves by approval pending a tax. But it is also a largely ignored historical fact that there were black slave owners in the antebellum South. In South Carolina alone in 1860, some 171 free blacks held over 760 slaves. And although black slave ownership was in decline after 1850, it had risen steadily until 1840. A few were planters, but many gravitated to the cities where their slaves worked as artisans. Before the international slave trade was banned in 1808, approximately 661,000 slaves were brought into the United States, or about 5% of all Africans transported across the Atlantic. America did not receive, by any stretch of the imagination, even a small portion of slaves shipped from Africa. Cuba topped the list with 787,000. But the slave population grew by allowing slave families to procreate, and therefore by 1860, the South had a slave population of 3.84 million, a figure that represented 60% of all the agricultural wealth in Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina. Other indicators reveal how critical a position slavery held in the overall wealth of the South. Wealth estimates by the U.S. government based on the 1860 census showed that slaves accounted for $3 billion in mostly Southern wealth, an amount exceeding the investments in railroads and manufacturing combined. To an extent, but only to an extent, the approaching conflict was won over the definition of property rights. As James Houston has argued in his persuasive study, Calculating the Value of the Union, the property rights argument was the ultimate defense of slavery, and white Southerners and the pro-slavery radicals knew it, and the weak point in the protection of slavery by property rights was the federal government. At any moment, the federal government could change the legal definition of property, thereby cutting the legs out from under slavery. And that threat was most prominent in the territories where slavery could still be prohibited, not in the states where it already existed. For that reason, the battlefield of the slavery debate steadily moved westward. Southern concerns over the protection of property rights in slaves, given the steady growing power of the federal government, were manifested in the emphasis on states' rights. It might therefore be said that whenever the historical record says states' rights in the context of sectional debates, the phrase rights to own slaves should more correctly be inserted. When Alabama's Franklin W. Bowden wrote about the property rights in slaves, "If any of these rights can be invaded, there is no security for the remainder," Northerners instinctively knew that the inverse was true. If one group of people could be condemned to slavery for their race, another could suffer the same fate for their religious convictions or their political affiliations. This aspect of slavery gnawed at the many non-slaveholders who composed the South's majority. Of all the Southerners who did own slaves, about 12% held most of the slaves, whereas some 36% of Southern farms in the most fertile valley regions had no slave labor at all. Overall, nearly half the farms in the Cotton Belt were slaveless. Indeed, in some regions, free farmers dominated the politics, particularly eastern Tennessee, western Virginia, northwestern Mississippi, and parts of Missouri. Even the small farmers who owned slaves steadily moved away from the large cash crop practice of growing cotton, entering small-scale manufacturing by 1860. If one had little land, it made no sense economically to hold slaves. A field hand in the 1850s could cost $1,200, although prices fell with age and remaining productive years. The stability and permanence of the system, however, arose from the large plantations, where a division of labor and assignment of slave gangs under the whip could overcome any inefficiencies associated with unfree labor. Robert Fogle and Stanley Ingerman, in their famous Time on the Cross, 1974, found that farms with slaves were 29% more productive than those without slaves, and, more important, that the gains increased as farm size increased. What is surprising is that the profitability of slavery was doubted for as long as it was. But that was largely because of the biased comments of contemporaries like anti-slavery activist Frank Blair, who wrote that no one from a slave state could pass through the splendid farms of Sangamon and Morgan without permitting an envious sigh to escape him at the evident superiority of free labor. Nathaniel Banks argued in the 1850s before audiences in Boston and New York that slavery was the foe of all industrial progress and the highest material prosperity. It was true that deep pockets of poverty existed in the South, and that as a region it lagged behind United States per capita value added average in 1860 by a substantial $7, falling behind even the undeveloped Midwest. Adding to the unprofitability myth was a generation of Southern historians that included Ulrich Bunnell Phillips and Charles Sidnor, who could not reconcile the immorality of slavery with the obvious returns in the market system. They used flawed methodologies to conclude plantations had to be losing money. A final argument that slavery was unprofitable came from the backwardness of the South, that is, its rural and non-industrial character, that seemed to confirm that slavery caused the relative lack of industry compared to that in the North. Conditions among slaves differed dramatically. Frederick Douglass pointed out that a city slave is almost a free citizen, who enjoyed privileges altogether unknown to the whip-driven slave on the plantation. A slave undertaker in Savannah hired other slaves and made payments to his master at $250 a year. Artisans, mechanics, domestic servants, millers, ranchers, and other occupations were open to slaves. Simon Gray, a Mississippi slave, became a lumber raft captain whose crew included whites. Gray also invested in real estate, speculated in raw timber, and owned several houses. Half of the workforce at the Richmond Tredegar Iron Works was composed of slaves. Even the most benign slavery, however, was always immoral and oppressive. Every female slave knew that ultimately, if her master chose to make sexual advances, she had no authority to refuse. The system legitimized rape, even though benign masters never touched their female slaves. Every field hand was subject to the lash. Some knew it more often than others. Much slavery in the South was cruel and violent, even by the standards of the defenders. Runaways, if caught, were mutilated or executed, sometimes tortured by being boiled in cauldrons, and slaves, for any reason, usually insubordination, were whipped. Free market advocates argue that it made no sense to destroy a $1,500 investment, but such contentions assume that the slave owners always acted as rational capitalists instead of, often, racists involved in reinforcement of social power structures. And it can never be forgotten that owning another person as property has always, in human history, produced a brutality inherent in the system. Often the two intermingled, the capitalist mentality and the racial oppression, to the point that the system made no sense when viewed solely in the context of either the market or race relations. For example, Fogel and Ingerman's antiseptic economic conclusion that slaves were whipped an average of 0.7 times per year is put into perspective by pictures of slaves whose backs were scarred beyond recognition by the whip. Fogel and Ingerman's data were reconstructed from a single slave owner's diary and are very questionable. Other evidence is that beatings were so frequent that they occurred more than once a week, and that fear of the lash permeated the plantations. Some states had laws against killing a slave, though the punishments were relatively minor compared to the act. But such laws wilted in light of the slave's actual testimony. "It's too bad to belong to folks that own you soul and body, that can tie you up to a tree with your face to the tree and your arms fastened tight around it, who take a long curling whip and cut the blood every lick. Folks a mile away could hear them awful whippings. They was a terrible part of living." Plantation slave diets could occasionally be rich in calories, but provisions seldom kept pace with the field labor, since data show that slaves born between 1790 and 1800 tended to be shorter than the free white population. In other respects, though, Fogel and Engerman were right. While many historians have overemphasized the breakup of families under slavery, a point hammered home by Harriet Beecher Stowe's fictional Uncle Tom's Cabin, fewer slaves were separated from their mates than is often portrayed in television or the movies. As the results of narratives from living former slaves collected during the New Deal by the Federal Writers Project, it has been determined that 2/3 had lived in nuclear families. If, however, 1/3 of all slave families were destroyed by force in the form of sales on the auction block, that statistic alone reiterates the oppressive and inhumane nature of the institution. Nevertheless, the old saw that crime doesn't pay does not always apply, as was the case with slavery, at least for over a century. Several economic historians have placed the returns on slavery at about 8.5%, leaving no doubt that it was not only profitable in the short term, but viable in the long run because of the constantly increasing value of slaves as a scarce resource. It would be equally mistaken, however, to assume that slave-based plantation agriculture was so profitable as to funnel the South into slavery in an almost deterministic manner. Quite the contrary. Studies of Southern manufacturing have revealed that returns in fledgling Southern industries often exceeded 22%, and in some instances reached as high as 45%. Yet even those profits were not sufficient to pry the plantation owners' hands off their slaves. So what to make of a discrepancy of 45% returns in manufacturing compared with 8% in plantation agriculture? Why would Southerners pass up such gains in the industrial sector? Economic culture explains some of the reluctance. Few Southerners knew or understood the industrial system. More important, however, there were psychic gains associated with slave-based agriculture, dominance, and control that one could never find in industry. Gains on the plantations may have been lower, but they undergirded an entire way of life and the privileged position of the upper tiers of Southern society. The short answer to our question, then, is that it was about more than money. In the end, the persistence of slavery in the face of high non-agricultural returns testifies to the aspects of its non-economic character. Ultimately, slavery could exist only through the power of the state. It survived because political forces prevented the typical decay and destruction of slavery experienced elsewhere. Laws forcing free whites to join posses for runaway slaves, censored males, and forbidding slaves to own property all emanated from government, not the market. Slaveholders passed statutes prohibiting the manumission of slaves throughout the South, banned the practice of slaves purchasing their own freedom, and used the criminal justice system to put teeth in the slave codes. States enforced laws against educating slaves and prohibiting slaves from testifying in court. Those laws existed atop still other statutes that restricted the movement of even free blacks within the South or the disembarking of free black merchant sailors in Southern ports. In total, slaveholders benefited from monumental reductions in the cost of slavery by, as economists would say, externalizing the costs to non-slave owners. Moreover, the system insulated itself from market pressures, for there was no true free market as long as slavery was permitted anywhere. Thus, there could be no market discipline. Capitalism's emancipating powers could work only where the government served as a neutral referee instead of a hired gun working for the slave owner. In contrast to Latin American countries and Mexico, which had institutionalized self-purchase, the American South moved in the opposite direction. It all made for a system in which, with each passing year, despite the advantages enjoyed by urban servant slaves and mechanics, slaves were increasingly less likely to win their freedom and be treated as people. Combined with the growing perversion of Christian doctrines in the South that maintained that blacks were permanent slaves, it was inevitable that the South would grow more repressive, both toward blacks and whites. Abraham Lincoln hoped that the natural limits of slavery would prove its undoing, that cotton production would peter out and slavery would become untenable. In this, Lincoln was in error. New uses for slave labor could always be found, and several studies have identified growing slave employment in cities and industry. Lincoln also failed to anticipate that slavery could easily be adapted to mining and other large-scale agriculture. And he did not appreciate the significance of the Southern Church's scriptural revisionism as it applied to blacks. In the long run, only the market or a war with the North could have saved the South from its trajectory. When slaveholders foisted the cost of the peculiar institution on the Southern citizenry through the government, no market correction was possible. Ultimately, Southern slave owners rejected both morality and the market, then went about trying to justify themselves. Defending the indefensible. Driven by the Declaration's inexorable logic that all men are created equal, pressure rose for defenders of the slave system to explain their continued participation in the peculiar institution. John C. Calhoun in 1838 noted that the defense of slavery had changed. This agitation from abolitionists has produced one happy effect. It has compelled us to look into the nature and character of this great institution and to correct many false impressions. Many once believed that slavery was a moral and political evil. That folly and delusion are gone. We now see it in its true light as the most safe and stable basis for free institutions in the world. Calhoun espoused the labor theory of value, the backbone of Marxist economic thinking, and in this he was joined by George Fitzhugh, Virginia's leading pro-slavery intellectual and proponent of socialism. Fitzhugh exposed slavery as the non-market anti-capitalist construct that it was by arguing that not only should all blacks be slaves, but so should most whites. "We are all cannibals," Fitzhugh intoned. "Cannibals all." Slaves Without Masters, the subtitle of his book Cannibals All, 1854, offered a shockingly accurate exposé of the reality of socialism, or slavery, for to Fitzhugh they were one in the same. Slavery in the South, according to Fitzhugh, scarcely differed from factory labor in the North, where the mills of Massachusetts placed their workers in a captivity as sure as the fields of Alabama. Yet African slaves, Fitzhugh maintained, probably lived better than free white workers in the North because they were liberated from decision-making. A few slaves even bought into Fitzhugh's nonsense. Harrison Berry, an Atlanta slave, published a pamphlet called Slavery and Abolitionism as Viewed by a Georgia Slave, in which he warned slaves contemplating escape to the North that subordination of the poor colored man there is greater than that of the slave South. And he added, a Southern farm is the beau ideal of communism. It is a joint concern in which the slave consumes more than the master, and is far happier because although the concern may fail, he is always sure of support. Where Fitzhugh's argument differed from that of Berry and others was in advocating slavery for whites. Liberty is an evil which government is intended to correct, he maintained in Sociology for the South. Like many of his northern utopian counterparts, Fitzhugh viewed every relationship as a form of bondage or oppression. Marriage, parenting, and property ownership of any kind merely constituted different forms of slavery. Here, strange as it may seem, Fitzhugh had come full circle to the radical abolitionists of the North. Stephen Pearl Andrews, William Lloyd Garrison, and earlier Robert Owen had all contended that marriage constituted an unequal, oppressive relationship. Radical communitarian abolitionists, of course, endeavored to minimize or ignore these similarities to the South's greatest intellectual defender of slavery. But the distinctions between Owen's subjection to the tyranny of the commune and Fitzhugh's blessings of liberation through the lash nearly touched, if they did not overlap, in theory. Equally ironic was the way in which Fitzhugh stood the North's free labor argument on its head. Lincoln and other Northerners maintained that laborers must be free to contract with anyone for their work. Free labor meant the freedom to negotiate with any employer. Fitzhugh, however, arguing that all contract labor was essentially unfree, called factory work slave labor. In an astounding inversion, he then maintained that since slaves were free from all decisions, they truly were the free laborers. Thus, Northern wage labor, in his view, was slave labor, whereas actual slave labor was free labor. Aside from Fitzhugh's more exotic defense of slavery, religion and the law offered the two best protections available to Southerners to perpetuate human bondage. Both the Protestant churches and the Roman Catholic Church, which had a relatively minor influence in the South except for Missouri and Louisiana, permitted or enthusiastically embraced slavery as a means to convert heathen Africans. And in 1822, the South Carolina Baptist Association published the first defenses of slavery that saw it as a positive good by biblical standards. By the mid-1800s, many Protestant leaders had come to see slavery as the only hope of salvation for Africans, thus creating the ultimate rationalization. Dr. Samuel A. Cartwright of New Orleans reflected this view when he wrote in 1852 that it was impossible to Christianize the Negro without the intervention of slavery. Such a defense of human bondage presented a massive dilemma, not only to the church, but also to all practicing Christians and, indeed, all Southerners. If slavery was for the purpose of Christianizing the heathen, why were there so few efforts made to evangelize blacks and, more important, to encourage them to read the Bible? Still more important, why were slaves who converted not automatically freed on the grounds that having become new creatures in Christ, they were now equals? To say the least, these were uncomfortable questions that most clergy and lay alike in Dixie avoided entirely. Ironically, many of the anti-slavery societies got their start in the South, where the first three periodicals to challenge slavery appeared, although all three soon moved to free states or Maryland. Not surprisingly, after the Nat Turner Rebellion in August 1831, which left 57 whites brutally murdered, many Southern churches abandoned their view that slavery was a necessary evil and accepted the desirability of slavery as a means of social control. Turner's was not the first active resistance to slavery. Colonial precedents included the Charleston Plot, and in 1807, two shiploads of slaves starved themselves to death rather than submit to the auction block. In 1822, a South Carolina court condemned Denmark Vesey to the gallows for, it claimed, leading an uprising. Vesey, a slave who had won a lottery and purchased his freedom with the winnings, established an African Methodist church in Charleston, which had 3,000 members. Although it was taken as gospel for more than a century that Vesey actually led a rebellion, historian Michael Johnson, obtaining the original court records, has recently cast doubt on whether any slave revolt occurred at all. Johnson argues that the court, using testimony from a few slaves obtained through torture or coercion, framed Vesey and many others. Ultimately, he and 35 conspirators were hanged. But the rebellion may well have been a creation of the courts. In addition to the Vesey and Nat Turner uprisings, slave runaways were becoming more common, as demonstrated by the thousands who escaped and thousands more who were hunted down and maimed or killed. Nat Turner, however, threw a different scare into Southerners because he claimed as the inspiration for his actions the prompting of the Holy Spirit. A sign appearing in the heavens, he told Thomas Gray, would indicate the proper time to fight against the serpent. The episode brought Virginia to a turning point, emancipation or complete repression, and it chose the latter. All meetings of free blacks or mulattoes were prohibited, even under the pretense or pretext of attending a religious meeting. Anne Arundel County, Maryland, enacted a resolution requiring vigilante committees to visit the houses of every free black regularly for prompt correction of misconduct, or in other words, to intimidate them into staying indoors. The message of the Vesey-Turner rebellions was also clear to whites. Blacks had to be kept from Christianity, and Christianity from blacks, unless a new variant of Christianity could be concocted that explained black slavery in terms of the curse of Ham, or some other misreading of scripture. If religion constituted one pillar of pro-slavery enforcement, the law constituted another. Historian David Grimstead, examining riots in the antebellum period, found that by 1835, the civic disturbances had taken on a distinctively racial flavor. Nearly half of the riots in 1835 were slave or racially related, but those in the South uniquely had overtones of mob violence supported or at the very least tolerated by the legal authorities. Censorship of mails and newspapers from the North forced conscription of free Southern whites into slave patrols and infringements on free speech all gradually laid the groundwork for the South to become a police state. Meanwhile, controversies over free speech and the right of assembly gave the abolitionists the issue with which they ultimately went mainstream: the problem of white rights affected by the culture and practice of slave mastery. By addressing white rights to free speech instead of black rights, abolitionists sanitized their views, which in many cases lay so outside the accepted norms that to fully publicize them would risk ridicule and dismissal. This had the effect of putting them on the right side of history. The Free Love and Communitarian Movement's association with anti-slavery was unfortunate and served to discredit many of the genuine Christian reformers who had stood in the vanguard of the abolition movement. No person provided a better target for Southern polemicists than William Lloyd Garrison. A meddler in the truest sense of the word, Garrison badgered his colleagues who smoked, drank, or indulged in any other habit of which he did not approve. Abandoned by his father at age 3, Garrison had spent his early life in extreme poverty. Forced to sell molasses on the street and deliver wood, Garrison was steeped in insecurity. He received little education until he apprenticed with a printer before striking out on his own. That venture failed. Undeterred, Garrison edited The National Philanthropist, a paper devoted to the suppression of intemperance and its kindred vices. Provided a soapbox, Garrison proceeded to attack gambling, lotteries, Sabbath violations, and war. Garrison suddenly saw himself as a celebrity, telling others his name would be known to the world. In his paper, Genius of Universal Emancipation, Garrison criticized a merchant involved in the slave trade who had Garrison thrown into prison for libel. That fed his martyr complex even more. Once released, Garrison co-founded an abolitionist paper, The Liberator, where he expressed his hatred of slavery and of the society that permitted it, even under the Constitution, in a cascade of violent language, calling Southern congressmen thieves and robbers. Abolitionism brought Garrison into contact with other reformers, including Susan B. Anthony, the Grimke sisters, Frederick Douglass, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Each had an agenda, to be sure, but all agreed on abolition as a starting point. Garrison and Douglass eventually split over whether the Constitution should be used as a tool to eliminate slavery. Douglass answered in the affirmative. Garrison, having burned a copy of the Constitution, obviously answered in the negative. The Political Pendulum. From 1848 to 1860, the South rode a roller coaster of euphoria followed by depression. Several times, solid guarantees for the continued protection of slavery appeared to be within the grasp of Southerners, only to be suddenly snatched away by new and even more foreboding signs of Northern abolitionist sentiment. This pendulum began with the election of Zachary Taylor, continued with the California statehood question, accelerated its swing with the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and finally spun out of control with the Dred Scott decision and its repercussions. The first swing of the pendulum came with the election of 1848. Van Buren's assumptions that only a northern man of southern principles could hold the nation together as president continued to direct the Democratic Party, which nominated Lewis Cass of Michigan. Cass originated a concept later made famous by Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, popular sovereignty. As Cass and Douglas understood it, only the people of a territory, during the process by which they developed their state constitution, could prohibit slavery. Congress, whether in its function as administrator of the territories or in its national legislative function, had no role in legislating slavery. It was a convenient out in that Cass and Douglas could claim they were personally opposed to slavery without ever having to undertake action against it, thus protecting them from Southern criticism over any new free soil states that emerged from the process. In reality, popular sovereignty ensured exactly what transpired in Kansas, that both pro- and anti-slavery forces would seek to rig the state constitutional convention through infusions of, often temporary, immigrants. Once the deed was done and a pro-slavery constitution in place, the recent arrivals could leave if they chose, but slavery would remain. Whigs, too, realized that the pro-slavery vote was strong and the free soil vote not strong enough to run strictly on slavery or related economic issues. They needed a candidate who would not antagonize the South, and many prominent Whigs fell in behind Zachary Old Rough and Ready Taylor, the Mexican War general. Taylor, however, was a Louisiana slaveholder who offended free soil Whigs who distrusted him. Taylor's ownership of slaves cost him within the party. Except for his Negroes and cotton bales, one congressman wrote, he would have won the nomination without opposition. Opposing Taylor was Henry Clay, ready for yet a fifth run at the presidency. But when Clay delivered an important address in Lexington, Kentucky, disavowing any acquisition of new slave territories in the Mexican War, he lost Southern support. His April 1844 Raleigh letter, in which he opposed annexation of Texas, did him irreparable damage. Privately, Taylor was less Whiggish than he let on. He told intimates that the idea of a national bank is dead and will not be revived in my time, and promised to raise tariffs only for revenue. But Taylor benefited from a reviving economy, which made the election almost entirely about personality, where he had the reputation and the edge. A third party, the new Free Soil Party, siphoned off both Democrats and Whigs who opposed slavery. The Free Soilers nominated Martin Van Buren, demonstrating the futility of Van Buren's earlier efforts to exclude slavery from the national political debate. Van Buren's forces drew in abolitionists, Liberty Party refugees, and conscience Whigs who opposed slavery under the slogan, "Free soil, free speech, free labor, and free men." Free soilers made a strong showing at the polls, raking in more than 10% of the vote, but did not change the outcome. Taylor won by an electoral vote margin of 163-137, and by a 5% margin in the popular vote. Virtually all of the free soil ballots would have gone to the Whigs, who, despite Taylor's slave ownership, were viewed as the anti-slavery party. It is probable that Ohio would have gone to Taylor if not for the free soilers. The new president was nevertheless something of an odd duck. He had never voted in an American election. He relished his no-party affiliation. Most Americans learned what they knew of him through newspaper accounts of his remarkable military victories. Indeed, in a sense, Taylor was the first outsider ever to run for the presidency. Jackson, although different from the elites which had dominated the White House, nevertheless willingly employed party machinery for his victory. Taylor, however, stressed his anti-party, almost renegade image much the way the populist candidates of the 1880s and independents like John Anderson and H. Ross Perot did in the 1980s and 1990s. The outsider appeal proved powerful because it gave people a sense that they could vote for the man largely on reputation or personality, without hashing out all the tough decisions demanded by a party platform. A Taylor supporter in Massachusetts claimed that enthusiasm for Taylor springs from spontaneous combustion and will sweep all before it. To assuage the concerns of Northern Whigs, Taylor accepted Millard Fillmore of Buffalo as his vice president. In policy, Taylor surprised both parties. Although he sympathized with the South's need to protect slavery, he wanted to keep it out of California and New Mexico. He announced that in due course, California, Utah, and New Mexico would apply for statehood directly, without going through the territorial stage. Under the circumstances, the states themselves, not Congress, would determine whether they allowed slaves. Taylor hoped to finesse the Southerners, reasoning that since they had already stated that they expected these territories to be free soil, there would be no need for the Wilmot Proviso. Nevertheless, he included a strong warning against the kind of disunion talk that had circulated in the South. When an October 1849 convention laid plans for a meeting of delegates from all the slaveholding states in Nashville the following year, attendees issued statements favoring disunion by leaders such as Congressman Robert Toombs of Georgia. Increasingly, such sentiments were invoked, and astute politicians of both sections took notice. California presented an opportunity for Henry Clay to regain the initiative he had lost in the nominating process. He started machinery in motion to bring California into the Union, a plan that constituted nothing less than a final masterful stroke at compromise by the aging Kentuckian. Clay introduced legislation to combine the 8 major points of contention over slavery in the new territories into 4 legislative headings. Then, his oratorical skills undiminished, Clay took the national stage one last time. His first resolution called for California's admission as a free state. Second, the status of the Utah and New Mexico territories were to be determined by popular sovereignty. Third, he proposed to fix the western boundary of Texas where it then stood, halting slavery for the time being by leaving the New Mexico territory intact. This provision also committed the federal government to assuming the debts of Texas, which was guaranteed to garner some support in the Lone Star State. Fourth, he sought to eliminate the slave trade in the District of Columbia, and, finally, he offered a fugitive slave law that promised to deliver escaped slaves from one state to another. Debate over Clay's compromise bill brought John Calhoun from his sickbed, although Senator James Mason of Virginia read Calhoun's speech, followed by stirring oratory from Daniel Webster. Both agreed that disunion was unthinkable. To the surprise of many, neither attacked the resolutions. Quite the contrary, Webster promised not to include Wilmot as a taunt or reproach, thereby extending the olive branch to the South. The debates culminated with Taylor supporter William H. Seward's famous higher law remark that there is a higher law than the Constitution. Meaning that if the Constitution permitted slavery, Seward felt morally justified in ignoring it in favor of a higher moral principle. Meanwhile, Clay thought that tactically he had guaranteed passage of the bill by tying the disparate parts together in a single package. While Clay and his allies worked to defuse the sectional crisis, Taylor became ill and died on the 4th of July. Millard Fillmore assumed the presidency amidst a rapidly unraveling controversy over the Texas-New Mexico border. Fillmore was the first president, other than the Adamses, to have not owned a slave at any time in his life, and as such, he was automatically suspect with the South. At the end of July, Clay's compromise measures were carved away from the omnibus bill and were defeated individually. Only Utah's territorial status passed. California statehood, the Texas boundary, the fugitive slave law, all went down to stunning defeat. The strain proved so great on the 73-year-old Clay that he left for Kentucky to recuperate. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi and Seward, arch-enemies of the compromise from opposite ends of the spectrum, celebrated openly. Their victory dance, however, did not last long. Another rising force in American politics had stood patiently outside these contentious debates. Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois. Born in Vermont, Douglas studied law before moving to Ohio in 1833. There he contracted typhoid fever, recovered, and moved on to Illinois. A natural politician, Douglas had supported continuing the 36-degree, 30-minute line and backed Polk on the Mexican War. In 1848, his new wife inherited more than 100 slaves, which tarnished his image in Illinois. He nevertheless was elected senator by the Illinois legislature in 1846, after which he chaired the important Committee on Territories. From that position, Douglas could advance popular sovereignty in the territories. When it came to the Compromise of 1850, Douglas saw the key to passage as exactly the opposite of Clay's strategy, namely bringing up the various resolutions again independently and attempting to forge coalitions on each separately. Moreover, Fillmore announced his full support of the compromise, and after accepting the resignation of the Taylor cabinet, named Webster as his Secretary of State. Meanwhile, Douglas maneuvered the Texas boundary measure through Congress. One explosive issue was settled, and Douglas quickly followed with individual bills that admitted California, established New Mexico as a territory, and provided a fugitive slave law. Utah's territorial bill also passed. The final vote on the fugitive slave law saw many Northerners abstaining, allowing the South to obtain federal enforcement. Douglas's strategy was brilliant and doomed. Lawmakers drank all night after its passage and woke up with terrible hangovers and a sense of dread. There is even a question as to whether it was truly a compromise. Few Southerners voted for any Northern provision, and few Northerners ever voted for any of the pro-Southern resolutions. All the compromise came from a group of Ohio Valley representatives who voted for both sides of the measures on the five ballots. The very states that would become the bloody battlegrounds if war broke out, Maryland, Tennessee, Missouri, Kentucky, provided the entire compromise element. For the North and South, however, the compromise was an agreement to maneuver for still stronger positions, with the North betting on congressional representation as its advantage and the South wagering on federal guarantees on runaway slaves. Fillmore called the compromise final and irrevocable, not noticing that secessionists had nearly won control of four lower southern state governments. By supporting the compromise, Fillmore also ensured that the anti-slavery wing of the Whig Party would block his nomination in 1852 in favor of Winfield Scott. Scott's enemies referred to him as Old Fuss and Feathers, while his supporters called him by the more affectionate Old Chippewa or Old Chapultepec after his military victories. A Virginian, Scott hoped to reprise the Whig Southerner success of Taylor 4 years earlier. The Democrats, meanwhile, closed ranks around their candidate, Franklin Pierce of New Hampshire. Neither side took seriously the virulent secessionist talk bubbling forth from the lower South. The pendulum swings north. Most man-made laws have unintended consequences. Such is human nature that even the wisest of legislators can seldom foresee every response to the acts of Congresses, parliaments, and Dumas. Few times, however, have legislators so misjudged the ramifications from their labor than with the Fugitive Slave Law. Several provisions of the law that Southerners saw as reasonable and necessary were guaranteed to turn ambivalent Northerners into full-fledged abolitionists. Runaway slaves were denied any right to jury trial, including in the jurisdiction to which they had escaped. Special commissions and not regular civil courts handled the runaways' cases. Commissioners received $10 for every runaway delivered to claimants, but only $5 for cases in which the accused was set free, and the law empowered federal marshals to summon any free citizen to assist in the enforcement of the act. Not only did these provisions expose free blacks to outright capture under fraudulent circumstances, but now it also made free whites in the North accessories to their enslavement. When it came to the personal morality of Northerners, purchasing cotton made by slaves was one thing. Actually helping to shackle and send a human back to the cotton fields was entirely different. This issue turned the tables on states' rights proponents by making fugitive slaves now a federal responsibility. The law had the effect of both personalizing slavery to Northerners and inflaming their sense of righteous indignation about being dragged into the entire process. And it did not take long until the law was applied ex post facto to slaves who had run away in the past. In 1851, for example, an Indiana black named Mitchum was abducted from his home under the auspices of the act and delivered to a claimant who alleged Mitchum had escaped from him 19 years earlier. The trials were stacked against blacks. The closer one got to the South, the less likely commissioners were to take the word of Negroes over whites, and any black could be identified as a runaway. Northerners responded not with cooperation, but violence. The arrest of a Detroit black man produced a mass meeting that required military force to disperse. A Pennsylvania mob of free blacks killed a slave owner attempting to corral a fugitive. And in Syracuse and Milwaukee, crowds broke into public buildings to rescue alleged fugitives. Politicians and editors fed the fire, declaring that the law embodied every evil that the radical abolitionists had warned about. Webster described the law as indescribably base and wicked. Theodore Parker called it a hateful statute of kidnappers, and Emerson termed it a filthy law. Whig papers urged citizens to trample the law in the dust, and the City Council of Chicago adopted resolutions declaring Northern representatives who supported it traitors, like Benedict Arnold and Judas Iscariot. Even moderates such as Edward Everett recommended that Northerners disobey the law by refusing to enforce it. Throughout Ohio, town meetings branded any Northern official who helped enforce the laws as an enemy of the human race. Even had this angry resistance not appeared, there remained many practical problems with the law. Enforcement was expensive. Boston spent $5,000 to apprehend and return one slave, and after that it never enforced the law again. Part of the expense came from the unflagging effort